Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
But look, we need to keep pressing on at the moment, so really delighted to have Sean and Marco leading on the next segment, which is the keynote. It's a panel going on there, which is what have I learned. So I'm just going to pass this bit on to you, Jessica, to continue on, if that's okay, please.
Wonderful. Good morning and good afternoon, depending on where you are in the country. I know that Sean and Marco are going to be facilitating this panel. I'm very pleased to be here myself. And I'm going to be speaking about equity and in response to Saku's point about deployment models, you know, looking at what do we really mean? What does it look like when you have bottom up in the US? So I'll pass it to Sean and Marco who are facilitating.
Yes. Thank you, John, David, and Jessica for bringing us into this session. I see Marco's on and Raimundo's on as well. And Duncan should be joining us here in a second. Marco, I don't know if I woke up feeling smart or not this morning. But
that's a good question.
It's a question every day I have. But the reality is we might be smart at one moment and then things change, right? And the next moment we might not be as smart. And I know some of the previous folks spoke to what a smart city looks like and what a smart society looks like. And we're going to take a look back in time to see what we've done thus far, how we've arrived to today, and perhaps learn and maybe even relearn some things to prepare for the future that we want.
I think that's actually what makes us human smart. I mean, the power to actually look back at the action and not just act by instinct, but learn from our mistakes. And having a goal to move forward that is probably way beyond just survival. We hope so. I think we passed that stage. Exactly. And I'm very, very excited to be here with a lot of friends that are part of this event. Then we've talked before. Many we will talk after this. So excited to see what we've learned so far. Where are we going with this?
Exactly. So just a quick round of introductions. So everybody heard Jessica Santos. She's a lecturer and scientist at Brandeis University. We also have Raimundo Rodolfo. He's the chief innovation officer and the chief information officer at City of Coral Gables, who we've spoken to before. And Anne Duncan should be joining once the camera gets working. She's a chief strategy and innovation officer for Dell, state and local government. She's a former CIO of Santa Clara County, and Anne can join us when she jumps on. Let's get the conversation started. Marco, what do you think?
I'm ready. I'm ready for the big question. What have we learned? How about we start with Jessica? I think you had time to reflect, and you know, we've been calling smart cities for a while, for a long time. But again, there is smart or smart. What level are we right now?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I totally agree with Sean. I think some days we're smart, some days we forget the lessons. And so I'm going to highlight a couple of lessons today that I've seen and heard and absorbed from both participating in and accompanying the Smart Cities initiative, but also from some of our research. And I'd like to start by talking about economic and racial justice and how we must think about those two as intertwined. So looking back into history, you mentioned maybe we're beyond survival mode. I'm not sure if that's true for everyone right now in our cities, right, Marco?
You're right. I should have paid more attention to what's happening, but I was talking about evolution in general.
I hear you. And I think that's right. I think we need to have both views going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. We need to have that high level evolutionary view, which I love about smart cities, and that tech driven, everything is possible. Let's just find the tools, right? And then we also have to bring ourselves into the lived experiences and realities of some of the communities that have been left behind in that evolutionary process. And so that's one of the biggest lessons that I'd like us to take forward moving into this global effort, really, is that if we can't create smart cities that provide well-being for all, then we haven't done our job. Right? It's not just cities being smart from a structural perspective and from an infrastructure and tech perspective. It's cities being smart about inclusion. And so when I speak about inclusion, I mean not just financially, not just economic, I mean racially. I mean, are they welcoming? Are we creating spaces in these particular sessions, right? In our own work, as well as, of course, in the work in the cities as a whole. So how do we do that? So I'll pause there. I just wanted to throw out those prompts. How do we do that? I can speak about some of the initiatives that I've seen, in particular around empowerment economics, you know, creating new models that are both looking to get the outcomes that we want through smart cities, but also the process being an incredibly empowering process that creates those welcoming cities, those welcoming environments, as well as the inclusive processes. But so that's where I'll start. Thank you.
That's great. And Raimundo, I'm going to turn to you. And Saku in the earlier session said it doesn't have to be about 30 years from now. And we've spoken about this a little bit, right? We have a moment now that we've led to, and we're in the midst of changes as well. Does it have to be 30 years from now to make sense and to get people involved?
3 years sounds like an eternity in technology. So like 5 years ago in technology is like history. So we have to live the present and think in terms right now of the next month. So how are we going to apply the lessons learned of yesterday to the next month? And how are we going to be able to be agile and adaptable in our learning? So how our learning cycle has to be shortened, and we have to achieve quick wins for the sake of public health, for the sake of public safety, for improving the life of our community as we move, as we have this journey. So some people say it's all about the journey, but the journey is now. And sometimes we need to make sure that we don't have analysis paralysis in terms of how we apply the lessons that we are learning throughout this fluid journey in the pandemic. So in our case, I think that smart city technologies have given us a great opportunity to apply these learnings, but also having a framework that is directly connected on one side to technology, on the other side to the people, and on the other side to the organizations that we make life and we make things happen.
Let's go back to Jessica and let's talk about community. One thing that we have had many conversations about on the magazine, it's about the intersection of society, technology, and ultimately, why do we use technology? Why do you use artificial intelligence and advanced technology? Ultimately, it should be for the well-being of humanity. So in the city, you always see like as a microcosm of what the entire planet is. How are we doing there? How are we
moving? That's a beautiful framing. Yes. that's a hard question. In some ways, yes. And in some ways, no. I think I see a rapid response abilities of cities around the country responding to the needs of, marginalized communities in the moment. And technology has facilitated that in a way that we've never had before. I also see, of course, advances being inequitable. So as, for example, just think about the entire world going remote right now due to COVID and all of the schooling implications and the gap that we know exists, not just in resources in general, but in just technology, in knowledge and in capacities to be able to respond to moments like that in our communities. So how can the city play a key role? And that's one of the questions that I think I've really enjoyed seeing evolve in these conversations is, for example, what I've learned from doing, you know, social science research in communities of color and together with communities of color is that communities of color have so many incredible solutions, creativity and resilience and the ability to navigate exclusion and also just need access to power to be able to put those into practice, right? Whereas also at a governmental and sometimes municipal city level, also incredible solutions and the power to put them in place. But if those don't align, then we're just widening that gap. And so I want cities to learn from communities and vice versa, even more so in this next wave. That's what I think we have not done well. And so although we see advances in certain ways, the reason why I say sometimes yes and sometimes no, I would say the no is more in the processes. We need to do a lot more work there. I think we need different partnerships, public-private from a high level, yes, absolutely, but public-private community, right? And that's like the, like, and I'm talking small organizations who are really out on the streets doing the work in cities. We don't have to think so big all the time. Sometimes we can bring it down to a local level, right? Like this is, and so that bubbling up of solutions and incredible models that, you know, Sakwa was asking, how do we make sure we don't all replicate or just kind of reinvent the wheel? Let's find out what's happening in those small spaces. That's where the magic is. And that's, I think, where the solutions are that can be scaled up. And then the cities, if cities are willing to really accept that shift in power as a part of this transition to more equitable spaces, more equitable municipalities, that's, I think, where my hope lies in terms of how we can continue to close those inequity gaps.
Yeah, and the risk is actually that we expand those gaps, because as technology multiply good things, if taken the wrong way, push the wrong button, it can multiply the bad things. So it's good to have that vision as well. And Sean, there's also physical security too.
there's a lot to consider, and many of us operate in the tech world, right? So we often look at this from a technical perspective, but there's so much to it. And in some of the earlier conversations this morning, there was a talk about adaptability, of course. Jessica, you just touched on scalability. We also have resiliency to deal with, and also sustainability, right? So kind of, are we building stuff now, and have we established a smart city or a smart ecosystem that can live on with us as we grow? And again, Ramona, we touched on this in one of our conversations before, but how do we, or what have we learned from the perspective of technology? Have we built stuff, and have we enabled and deployed things that are setting ourselves up for the future? Or what do we need to look back upon and say, okay, we need to push the reset button here, or we need to fine tune these things here?
So I would say that every smart city project, so it's not technology. So we talked about that in our previous conversation. It's about achieving the strategic goals of your organization and your community. So it's a reflection of your community. So every smart city journey starts with understanding the needs and the priorities of your community, and also aligning that with the vision and the core values of your city, of your foundation, legacy in your city, with your history, with your character in your community. So once you do that alignment, and there are many ways to do that today. It can be a co-creative process. So you create together. So you create a smart city plan together with your community. And we use the traditional methods like citizen boards, engaging them in that co-creative process and design thinking and other things. But we also do it with technology. We have the latest tools like the application of artificial intelligence and machine learning for public sentiment analytics. We do that. So we analyze all that public sentiment too, and we engage the citizens through our smart city hub and other ways. So basically, if this was a system design, it is a system with a loop. It's a feedback loop. And so basically you have input, you have outputs, and those citizens also, they come back to you later to refine the model. So the model has to perfect itself with constant input from the voice of the customer, what we call in quality engineering, the voice of the customer. So your citizens are your customers. So you have to continuously listen to that voice, and that will make the plan actionable.
Yeah, I love it. And Anne, you're back.
I'm back, and sorry about that. I had the technology gremlins. First I couldn't share, and then I had no control. So once someone muted me, I couldn't unmute myself.
Well, that's the beauty of the live event.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
We're thrilled to have you on, and I'm really interested in your perspective on this. And what I want to talk about with you is the idea that we learn from each other. And you've had the opportunity to see a lot of things in a lot of different places, and I suspect even involved in some of the clusters that are established throughout the country and elsewhere. So your view on what we've been able to learn from each other over the past few years and how that might take us into the future.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating situation we're in right now. We're all in very much uncharted territory, dealing with this, a black swan event that certainly some people expected, but most of us were oblivious to. I think that one of the most important things, from the government perspective, that I have seen is what I sort of knew in my heart, which is government can really move very, very fast when we take a lot of constraints off of government. And I think that is a message for us to rethink how we work together. To say, how can we make our world one where we can work like that all the time? We've created a lot of constraints, many of which we've created either for political reasons or, well, generally for political reasons, whether it's because of things people have done in the past or because of things we want to achieve in the future. We've handcuffed a lot of our institutions, and we've also painted them with a brush that isn't true. I was listening to Scott McNeely, and I was struck when he said that government is inherently political, which is a misunderstanding of government, right? Government, the civil service, is inherently apolitical, right? And in fact, works extraordinarily hard to be apolitical. But many of the constraints we've placed around our systems are based on misconceptions like that, whether it's government's inherently political or businesses are only out for themselves or, whatever it may be, none of those things are fully true. And so how can we use this time to rethink some of those assumptions that we have, because we've demonstrated some of them are wrong, right? So what's the opportunity here for us to change some of the assumptions we operate under to make ourselves more effective as a society? There's my big question.
Are there any assumptions that we've made? Anybody want to highlight any that we've made that have proven not good choices?
I would say that government can be entrepreneurial. Government can innovate. Government can develop patents and new ideas too.
I think to Anne's point, the idea that the assumptions are then also reflected in narratives, right? That accompany those assumptions and are so powerful. And so I always think about the meritocracy narrative that we have in our country, which can be pretty harmful when you're working towards kind of like a community level, equitable goal, where those who have been marginalized, historically excluded, will internalize this idea that if we could just work harder, or that the opportunity structures are there and we just need to access them. Those who have not been able to will internalize that and blame themselves, right? And so how can the Smart Cities Initiative, sorry, I love the cat. How can the Smart Cities Initiative create some counter narratives to some of those things that move us all towards a more collective way of, okay, we're in this together. Let's take those mental constraints off as well, right? And I think part of doing that is looking at the way our cities are structured right now. And then the constraints, I like that constraints model, right? We think the systems operate in a certain way. We have evidence that they can operate differently, yet our narratives are so strong that we're kind of stuck. So let's look more closely appreciate what is happening and then take those mental constraints off.
Yeah, and I know, Jessica, you look a lot at the digital divide, and I'm wondering, how do we give a voice to the citizens that may not even be connected in the first place? And then those that are, that have an interest, how do we educate them so that they can learn with the community and with those supporting it? Obviously, universities and academia and schools have a huge role to play. Governments have a role to play, the cities themselves. So maybe, Anna, I'll turn to you. How do we give a voice to the citizens, and how do we educate them so that they know what questions they're asked to ask and what comments to perhaps even make?
Well, if I had the answer to that, I think I'd have a book written by now, at least. You know, I think that, and I apologize, I picked him up, this guy, to get him to stop crying. So hopefully he'll settle. So, you know, I think that we have spent a number of years creating a situation where we've convinced people that being educated and being involved is either not helpful or not cool, right? It's, you know, I mean, what was the biggest criticism of Barack Obama is that he was well-educated. He was an elitist. So I think we need to start from a very fundamental level of helping the members of the public understand that education is valuable, it's important, and that we all need to be educated not only on the basics, but on how our government works and how to engage. You know, and if I were able to sort of have my little magic wand out, I would create a required government service for everybody a couple of years, and maybe not when you're 18, but maybe when you're 28 or 30, when you can really understand, appreciate, and maybe engage a little higher level in government. But I think that if members of the public understood government better and were more educated about government, we would have a more effective government and a more effective society in general. But, you know, going back to the other part of that question about the digital divide, we do need as a country to solve that problem. Right? The Obama administration was working on it in 2015 and 2016 at the end of the term, trying to figure out how to solve the broadband issue. That's one of the problems, right? One of the problems is access, and one of the problems is affordability. So if I can't access it because it's not there, that's a problem. But if I can't afford it, even though it's there, that's a problem too. And we need to solve both of those problems. And part of the way to do that is just like we did with rural electrification, or rural telephone service, is to say that, you know, this is an essential service, and we're going to deliver that essential service to everybody. We're going to subsidize it. So those are the kind of conversations I think we need to have is one, the value of education, and two, creating that access and making it a universal right.
And I want to thank you so much for throwing me this passage, this ball, because we're kind of wrapping here, and I feel like Lana Laws, we could go on all day, but I think we're going to piss off somebody.
She won't mind.
So to wrap this conversation, I'm going to take it right from where Anne went. Like, I think it's a global effort. We can't just be doing it on pocket, on silos, or how you want to call it. And I'm going to go to Raimundo, and then maybe a quick round just to wrap this up and talk about how we're going to globalize this effort to look at a better future and outcome. And I'm going there, Raimundo, because when we were on that talk with Singapore, that's exactly what we talked about, learning from each other, cooperating with each other. So let's make a quick round of, you know, positive here.
So I would say, me coming from the telecommunication industry, so from the private sector, I have to build on what Anne was saying. So a foundation of broadband and high-speed communications is key. And that can be part of the cooperation and the way how we collaborate. So building those fiber corridors between municipalities and counties. So that seems we have to start doing that. So from a practical standpoint, so maybe, you know, that's something that we focused at the very beginning of our smart city plan. So building that foundation, and everything else came out of that. And we did it for resilience too, because you need to help the local businesses and communities to recover after a hurricane or after another disaster. And communications is key. So, and democratize the access of data with open data, open portals that also invite the members of the community to contribute. It's a two-way communication. So I think that it's a foundation, and collaboration can play a big role in that, because those efforts are very expensive and very difficult, and they need to be done together.
Anne, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think to echo the Romando, the foundation is connectivity and education. And so we need to give people access to the education that they need, and then we need to educate them. But we got to start by creating that access.
Jessica, bring us home.
So, you know, building off both Raimundo and Anne, I would say, you know, rethinking what is essential in this new world that we're in. What is an essential service? What are essential sectors? And then having cities, you know, collaborate, private, public, community. I think that communities don't need education so much as they have education within them, and it needs to be drawn out. We need the civic education that Anne was describing, engagement, not just about government, but just engagement, literally. Like, how can we have a stake in our cities and in our communities together? So thank you.
Yeah, and I think we've covered quite a bit in today's conversation. Obviously, we touched on the need to collaborate, the importance of education. This is all about what have we learned. And I think as I kicked it off, I said, we're always learning and relearning. And I think that's the whole point of this 3 days session that Lan and the whole team put together. And just a quick tease, because I think there's a lot for everybody to learn, even if it's not just your own space. So even what are the sessions here? We have smart, secure cities today, cybersecurity and privacy tomorrow, and smart, secure communities the day following, with people from government, academia, to private sector, public sector. And I think there's crossover into areas that you haven't spent some time in, and see what other folks are thinking about and what they're concerned with. And I think that's where we will really learn. What do you think, Marco?
Well, I think that's, again, I go back to the fact that it's a microcosmos. Some are smaller than others. We've talked to in the past with small municipality that are moving towards being smart. We talked about how sometimes may be easier. I mean, even Raimundo, your city is not the Singapore or New York, but it's maybe even a better terrain for testing things because it allows you to be a little bit more flexible. The big city are dealing with larger problem, maybe bigger budget, but larger problem. So it's about the tech, it's about the security, it's about the society, and it's about looking at our future with a goal and not just taking the tech and see where it goes. And if we find the wall, we hit our head, we turn around and we keep going. No, let's think, let's plan. And I think that events like this are extremely important. And I'm so glad that we had Sean the opportunity to start this today, because again, many friends, many smart people that I'm sure will leave us with a lot of questions. And that's what success for me is. I know you like to ask how you measure success. I think on event, you measure success by how many questions you have more than how many answers you have.
Things to go look up and continue to learn on.
Get your thing going. You know?
Exactly. So Anne, Jessica, Raimundo, it's an absolute pleasure. Lan, thank you to you and the rest of the team for putting this together. With that, John David, we'll hand it back over to you and
to the next.
And see you later.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you all.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and the story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.